You've heard AM, you've heard FM. Now, tune in to DM Radio, the world's longest-running show about data. Each week, host Eric Cavanaugh interviews the brightest minds in the world of information management. Want to be on a show? Send an email to info@dmradio.biz. Now, here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, yes, indeed, it's time once again. It's time for DM Radio. This is your host, Eric Cavanaugh. Today, we're going to talk about a really, really cool subject area. It's all about the arms race in the data centers. That's right, a data center arms race is what we're talking about. Arms race, right? ARM makes chips, makes processors. Of course, we have lots of companies in Austin that make processors. Companies all around the world that make processors. We've gone from the CPU to, of course, the GPU, the graphics processing units, and we got all the gamers in the world to thank for that revolution. And now we have something called TPUs. We're going to hear about that today and how they're specifically designed for enabling machine learning. So we have great guests for you today, folks. We're going to hear from Keno Fisher of Julia Computing, Patrick McFadden from DataStax, and Chris Carter from Aproyo. Big thanks to our friends Dataversity, our partner out there. EDW is coming up, Enterprise Data World in Boston. Hope to see you all there. Hop online to dataversity.net for all the latest about that. And with that, I'm tweeting right now. It's a data center arms race today on DM Radio. That's right. We're going to talk to DataStax, Aproyo, and Julia Computing about Google and Amazon and Microsoft and all these guys. They're all in the data center world these days, right? And wow, how much have things changed in just the last 5 to 7 years? I thought that cloud computing would really take off in 2012, 2013 timeframe. Back then, Amazon was already rocking just an amazing portfolio with Amazon Web Services. They basically had a 10-year head start. And it's only thanks to, I think, Microsoft that the playing field is being leveled out right now, because let's face it, they have gone whole hog into cloud with Azure. They're really focused on it, and it's probably a good thing for us. So it is a bit ironic that Microsoft is going to be saving us from the monopoly of Amazon. I find that interesting. But it's happening. But now Google is getting very serious. So let's bring in our first guest, Keno Fisher from Julia Computing. Tell us a bit about yourself and a bit about these TPUs, these TensorFlow processing units from Google.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Keno Fisher. I'm CTO at Julia Computing, which is a company that works on the Julia programming language. And as such, I obviously have a lot of exposure to cutting-edge topics in computing, and in particular these days in machine learning. So my particular area is working on the compiler of the programming language, sort of the very low level parts that actually make it run. So I see this arms race in the data center firsthand, and I actually did recently work on porting Julia to Google's tensor processing units. So as you mentioned in your introduction, we have CPUs, which are very fast at executing general purpose instructions, GPUs, which are serially a lot slower, but run a lot of computations in parallel. And then specifically in the machine learning space, we now have TPUs, which were chips specifically developed by Google and have powered a lot of Google's and DeepMind's recent AI advances. So things like the StarCraft playing bot, things like the AlphaZero, the Go playing bot, and even things like the recent language model, the OpenAI, that they decided not to release for fear of misuse. All of these advances have been driven by Google's TPUs, and these chips, however, are only available on Google Cloud in the data center. So you can't just go to Google and buy one of them. So it's something that Google is trying to do in this data center arms race to distinguish themselves from the competition.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting. So, of course, a data center is just a whole bunch of hardware, right? I mean, it's hardware and software, obviously, mixed together. With the change that we're seeing in the marketplace is that historically, large organizations built their own data centers. Everybody did this. Every Fortune 500 company, I'm sure, has data centers. And it's kind of interesting how quickly the inflection point seems to have hit. And I think it's largely because you've got companies like Google, companies like Amazon, focusing so intently on the next big battleground. That's why we're calling it an arms race, right? This is a battleground. Those companies are going to be vying to be the data centers of the future, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you see, and Google certainly sees TPUs as a way to distinguish themselves from the competition, but they're not the only ones who are building custom hardware. I mean, Amazon has been in the custom hardware business for their cloud services for a really long time. So they have custom chips that run their network in the data center and that allow them to get additional performance by offering sort of bare metal servers as opposed to virtualized servers. And both Amazon and Microsoft are looking at providing FPGAs on the cloud, which is sort of reconfigurable, bring your own chip devices running on the cloud attached to these devices.
Mm-hmm. And you bring up a couple of really good points here. So just for the sake of our audience, a lot of people know VMware, they know virtualization. That whole movement came around, gosh, I guess it's got to be 20 odd years ago now, maybe 25. And the idea was you would virtualize the infrastructure that you have to get the most use out of it, right? So they've made tremendous advances, but things are now changing. And so when you talk about bare metal versus virtualized, the thing with any kind of virtualized environment is that there is a tax. It's an abstraction level. And so you're going to slow things down a little bit, and you can boost performance by going bare metal, as you describe, by really focusing on a purpose-built piece of hardware, software, and appliance, as we call it, right, to be able to optimize certain choke points or certain throughput in your environment. So that's interesting stuff. And I'm kind of fascinated by how much advance we're seeing now, right? Because the cycle time on developing a new chip, I mean, I have to think it's at least 18 months from concept to production. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's about right. Generally, it can be even longer. It certainly depends on the complexity of the chip and who's doing it. But all of these chip investments are, you know, multi-hundred million dollar investments that these companies are doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the key then is to have an ecosystem, right? So we've had this battle before on the show talking about open source versus closed source. And on the show today, we've got Patrick McFadden from DataStax. And of course, they sit on top of an open source database. And it's kind of an interesting dynamic right now, right? I mean, open source has won in some ways in the computing world, in the software world. I think it's sort of a de facto standard. Now Linux is the standard operating system for most enterprise systems. But now, to your point, we're seeing some fairly guarded moves. And it's a difficult thing to do, because if you open up to the ecosystem, you get a lot of ideas, you get a lot of feedback, and you can kind of get a critical mass of development around your solution. But if you don't do that, well, then you can protect what you have, and it's proprietary. How do you think these companies, Kino, make that determination of whether or not to embrace the ecosystem or to just keep it to themselves? How does that calculus work?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. So I obviously also work on an open source ecosystem, and contrasting it with TPUs, for example, which were originally entirely proprietary to Google and are still to a very large extent proprietary and has just been gradually opening up, I think all these companies are, you know, afraid of losing their edge if they allow too many people to know what they're doing. On the other hand, if they don't tell people what their hardware can do or what their software can do, then how will the researchers ever know whether it's applicable to their problems, and how will they ever leverage, you know, the greatest proprietary hardware out there? So I'm a very, very big proponent of being as open as possible and competing on, you know, raw performance as opposed to trying to build some sort of proprietary moat.
Right. That's actually a good segue to bring in Patrick McFadden from DataStax. So, Patrick, you were joking in the pre-call that you guys are like the Switzerland, right? You don't really care where it is. But what do you think about this dynamic that we're seeing just in general? And what do you think about the future of the data centers from the DataStax perspective?
Well, I mean, this is I've joked we were like the Switzerland because our database, Apache Cassandra, and what we've built a business around is a database that's distributed everywhere. I mean, if you have a local data center, if you're in the cloud, we don't really care. We'll run anywhere. But that's also given us a lot of insight into how people are thinking right now. And it is an arms race because businesses now have to work fast and run in an agile fashion. And then where you put your data is really important. But now it's like it's this race to the bottom. How much power can I get out of my data center with the least amount of cost? And I thought that was interesting with the TPU. Now we're optimizing GPU. now it's like, here we go. Now is the next thing. we're concerned, DataStax, like where your data is, but it's really interesting what people are doing with that data. And it has a cost, a lot of cost. So I'm very interested to see this trend go forward.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, it's at the end of the day, any arms race is about being faster, sharper, more accurate, less cost, whatever the case may be. You've got all these standard metrics to come into play. But kind of to Kino's point, and what I've seen is that usually collaboration and an ecosystem approach is going to allow the overall community of end users of companies that leverage these technologies to get the most out of it. And I think that there may be some advantage to these companies keeping it to themselves, but to me, I think it's a bit of a missed opportunity only because of, I guess, a couple of factors. One, in the software world, I've found that almost invariably, end users will find creative ways to use what you designed that you had never imagined. And it'll be really cool stuff that you just hadn't thought was going to happen. You'd have something in your mind of what you think is going to happen, and then you get out there in the market and things change. So that's one consideration to keep in mind. But the other consideration is just it's very difficult, except to a very discerning audience, to describe the difference in capabilities between some of these really complex offerings. And so at the end of the day, are you actually harming your sales efforts by not telling people what's going on? One of the benefits that I've seen from the open source movement, I think, I'll throw this over to you, Patrick, is that because the source code is open, people are willing to talk about what it does, how it works, why it works a certain way. I've noticed that some of the closed source software companies that are still around, there are many of them, are very much more guarded about what they say. And so if you do an interview with them, it's almost like talking to a politician. You can't get to the kernel of what you're trying to understand because they're afraid of tipping their hand. And so I think in general, the ecosystem, the open approach is better for everyone involved, for the purveyor of the technology and for the user of the technology. But what do you think, Patrick?
Well, open source software has, and I think the thing that you're pointing at, it's not the software so much sometimes, it's the standard that you're building around. Mm-hmm. And right. Open APIs are a thing now, and the standardizing around a certain query language, how we deploy software. So, I can use Cassandra as an example. It's CQL, Cassandra Query Language. That's open. It's out there. The spec is on the Apache GitHub site. So you can go look at it. Everybody can implement it in their own way. I think of things like Spark as well, analytics language. It's an API, basically. It's using data frames to look at your data. And I would guarantee you, if this is another part of the Spark project, is it's going to be running on GPU. And probably TPUs as well. So if you're building, and I think of like, here's a company that's trying to build momentum around their product, let's say company X, and they're going to use APIs and certain products, or projects, then where are they going to deploy it? And if this is the backlash that I'm seeing everywhere right now, especially in the larger businesses, is I don't want to get locked into something that Amazon or Google or Microsoft has because I want portability. So I'm going to adopt some open standard, open source software that runs there. And you can see the backlash. There's a lot of open source projects right now that are trying to change their license terms because they don't want these big cloud providers to, subsume the project. They want them to implement it. That's fine. But, talk about arms race. Like, what are you going to deploy? Where are you going to deploy it? And that, you know, that open software, you know exactly how it runs, or at least you have a good idea how it works from underneath the covers, but you also have that open API that everyone can use, and it isn't locked into one provider.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, it is, it's a dynamic that we need to understand and appreciate and work around. But there is a certain fear, right, that these giants will just consume all the open source stuff, not give back to the community. I mean, if you talk to some of the folks from the earlier days of Yahoo, that's what you hear. I've heard that story from quite a few different people, that lots of folks inside the engineering team at Yahoo, and this is talking like, I want to say late 90s, early aughts, basically, because that was the epicenter of innovation, from what I can tell. And I say that because 8-10 years after that, you had a whole flurry, almost like a Cambrian explosion of new technologies that spun out of that program at Yahoo. And what these guys say is they were putting the screws to senior management saying, you need to give back to the open source community. And so that there has been this ebb and flow over a number of years, right? But it's hard to say exactly where it stands. And we have to be cognizant of the competitive reality, is that Amazon is competing with Microsoft, is competing with now other major vendors too. And that's that whole co-opetition thing, it's kind of a strange nut to crack, right, Patrick?
I think Amazon is competing with everybody. Amazon's competing with everybody. I mean, that's the, we call this in our world, the Amazon effect. You know, you look at a company like Target, for instance, who their CEO made the call on infrastructure. They said, we're moving out of AWS because we're tired of giving Amazon, who's our competitor in retail, the money. Walmart is another good example, publicly said, we're not going to put our data or allow our vendors to put their data in Amazon because they're our competitor in retail. So there's decisions being made at a level that have nothing to do with technology.
Yeah. No, that's about right. And we'll pick this up after the break, but I agree with you. And frankly, I was kind of surprised 5 years ago to see the number of companies, and it is a long, long list, that quite literally put all of their bags in the Amazon basket. Because I'm thinking to myself, guys, like, this is pretty dangerous. You're going to be stuck in there. And I've actually seen a couple companies already kind of get sucked into the maw that way. There's a company, Parexel, I knew very well, which created technology, analytic database technology, that went into Redshift. And then I remember asking some of the guys from the company, well, it doesn't make a lot of sense because you want to sell it for high dollars and they're going to sell it for low dollars. How's that all going to map out? And long story short, Parexel went out of business. Now what's left of that technology is in Amazon Redshift. But yeah, so strange times indeed, folks. We'll be right back after this break. Don't touch that dial. You are listening to DM Radio.
Ask yourself, if you built a van for your business, where would you start? At the beginning, of course, with the people who invented the work van over 100 years ago, Mercedes-Benz. You'd give your new Mercedes-Benz Sprinter advanced technology and safety to keep you connected and protected. You'd make it available in diesel and gas, and there would be thousands of configurations and upfits to choose from. You'd build it right here in the USA, because your one-of-a-kind business deserves nothing less than a van that's built for you. Introducing the all-new Mercedes-Benz Sprinter, the safest, most innovative Sprinter yet, starting at just $33,790. Built for you, the all-new Sprinter, built in the USA. Mercedes-Benz. Vans. Born to run.
MSRP excludes all options, taxes, title, registration, transportation charge, and dealer prep fee. Options, model availability, and actual dealer price may vary. See dealer for details about costs and terms. Equipment described as optional. 2019 Mercedes-Benz Sprinter available soon.
Here's today's top automotive tech story. I'm Nick Miles. Kia introduces its new flagship SUV, the Telluride, packed with automotive tech, including the Kia DriveWise suite of advanced driver assistance systems and an available 10.25-inch color touchscreen with rear view monitor and parking guidance. Telluride will have available wireless smartphone charging, available 6 total USB charging ports, multi-Bluetooth wireless connectivity, allowing 2 phones to connect simultaneously. For more cool car tech, visit testmiles.com.
Here's the thing about bragging rights. They don't come with trophies or medals. But when your Tacoma with crawl control powers over a gnarly patch of rocks, there's nothing more satisfying than throwing it in your buddy's face. Learn more at toyota.com/testmiles.
You're listening to Global American Broadcasting, the Gab Radio Network. For more info on our programs and services, including technical operations and syndication, please visit GabRadioNetwork.com.
There's only one thing left to do, and that's to give up. Maybe you've given up too. Maybe you've done it because you've tried everything else that you can think of. I'll explain next on Dan's Life.
There is no better way to make a more comfortable home for the new year than a visit to the semi-annual white sale going on now at thecompanystore.com. From our famous LaCrosse down comforters and pillows to the finest quality sheets, towels, bedding basics, and home decor, you'll find everything you need to stay warm in winter and then start spring with style. Receive 20% off your entire order and get free shipping when you enter the code RADIO19 at checkout. Thecompanystore.com. We're all about comfort.
Years ago, I found out in a shocking way that one of my best friends was using the bad stuff, heroin. A dude zoned out, kind of like the snake in the Disney animated Robin Hood when he would cast that spell. My friend beat heroin, or at least shook it off, for a few years, but he's back. Oh, he's tried to keep it from me and everyone else, but it explains a lot. The nodding off, the inability to keep working consistently or persistently, and the quality of his work being subpar and far short of his capabilities. And the lies, the stupid little lies, the excuses, the table turning, the gaslighting, suggesting that everyone else is really the problem, that they've got it out for him. It wears thin, and it's transparent. No amount of criticism, guilting, yelling, screaming, or encouraging, loving, can undo the grip of this most vile of addictions. So I've given up. I've moved on. Because you can't change a junkie. Only they can do that. It's depressing. It's heartbreaking. And it's all too common. I'm hopeful that my friend can get clean. I hope to welcome him back to the land of the living one day, because for me, all I see in his eyes now is a death coming sooner than it need, one without nobility or decency of what could have been's, fleeting as the high in which he is perpetually chasing.
Welcome back to DM Radio. Here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
All right, folks, back here on DM Radio. I have to say, we came up with one of the sexiest titles that our guests actually came up with it in the pre-call, the data center arms race. We're going to do that next year. In fact, I'll write that down. Now I have one of 40 shows already planned for next year. That's great. The data center arms race is what we're talking about. In the first segment, we heard from Keno Fisher from Julia Computing and my buddy Patrick McFadden from DataStax. And now we have Chris Aproyo, Carter from Aproyo. And Chris, you're sort of perfectly suited for this conversation today because you understand data centers and you understand SAP. And of course, SAP, the German software juggernaut, they're really hitting on all cylinders these days from what I've seen. And that's largely because of the vision of their founder. And I've always been impressed by Hasso Plattner. I think he's a man with great vision and a great attitude and a great sense of humor. He says some funny stuff. He was at Sapphire a couple of years ago talking about the vision, and they had a slide up on the screen that said something like 70-something percent of all major procurement transactions happen through SAP. And he looks up and he shakes his head and goes, "I don't believe that number." Like, what? He's just disagreeing with his comms team on the stage in front of, 40,000 people. That's pretty funny. But anyway, Hasso had a vision many years ago, like 12 years ago now, that they threw down the gauntlet and said, we're going for an in-memory architecture. And what that means for the lay listener out there is that instead of using spinning disk, like most computers have used, up until recently, it's just all solid state. There's no spinning disk. It's all solid state. It's all memory. There are different levels of memory, different levels of cache, et cetera. But that's a pretty bold vision. And so from a data center perspective, well, guess what? That throws an interesting wrinkle into the equation that not every major data center can handle. So Chris Carter from Aproyo, tell us a bit about that and how you see that shaking out in this whole data center arms race.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct with the arms race that's going on. You've got, let's say the clouds, AWS, GCP, Google Cloud, and then Microsoft Azure. So we'll stick with those three just at the high level. And then from the data center perspective, you could pick any data center that's out there, CyrusOne, Rackspace, TCM, whoever the case may be. from a in-memory perspective, because you're using virtualization tools and it's SAP, which is a kind of a, let's call it a big footprint, you've got to be able to up your ante. Now, there are activities from a SAP perspective that you cannot put in certain clouds. Some work in others, some do not work in either or any of them, and you have to put that on a bare metal or virtualized appliance inside of a data center, be it your own or a third party. And because of the way that SAP structures itself, it still partners with all three of them, but it just says when you go out there and you look at a build schema, each build schema is different because of each one has its own proprietary way to set up a system and the way that they've built it. No matter what facility they're in, they're still going to be different. And so it really, you need the folks like myself and others who know the difference between each of the data centers, between each of the clouds, and to be able to give you the insight of what's going on with GCP, Azure, or AWS. And that's why it's really an arms race, because those three, they want to rule the SAP world. AWS had to start, but Azure is coming on, and now Google's trying to get into it. But it's definitely an arms race between those three, that's for sure.
Yeah, and this is important stuff, right? Because let's face it, companies like SAP really do execute many, if not most, or certainly a plurality of transactions at enterprise scale. When Hershey's goes out and buys, you know, 1,000 tons of chocolate, for example, that's going through SAP. So these are major, major platforms. And, you know, it's challenging for a whole lot of different reasons. And I'll throw this one back over at you, Chris. And I think that there is a great effort on the part of these major vendors, especially, you know, like we say, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, at explaining what they have and how it all works. But it's kind of dizzying in terms of the complexity. And if I'm a regulator, for example, it's going to be hard to kind of navigate that world and understand what's happening, especially when you get into things like security threats, bad actors doing various things. You know, you want to have some level of transparency that at least the auditors can see things. But guess what? If you give that kind of transparency, you're kind of giving it to someone else too. So it's a real sticky wicket. But what do you think, Chris?
Fully agree. Between InfoSec and the auditing teams, the nuances that you have to get down into in order to make sure that you are regulatory compliant, and I'm going to stress that term, regulatory compliant for a lot of these major manufacturers and organizations who, banks, U.S. Bank, Wells Fargo, those two, you've got to be compliant. If you're not dealing with it at the lowest optimal level, down to the byte level inside these clouds, you're not going to pass your regulatory compliance activities, and you're going to get massive fines. And some of these companies just don't understand how deep they need to go in order to make sure that they are compliant. So these organizations that are looking to hire an aid to Amazon, GCP, whatever, they really need to learn what they need to do. And they need to talk with their auditing teams and their security teams to make sure of those compliances. Because none of them, I can guarantee you, are just going to hand you the keys to the castle and say, here you go, here's my byte level. Go ahead and audit me.
Well, that's exactly right. And of course, what's going to happen here, and maybe let's go around the room and bring in our other, I'll throw one more question over you, Chris, but I think what's going to happen is you're going to have to see some of these agencies, these government agencies, go out and hire people who work for these companies, right? And that's when things get really interesting, because now you'll get a guy who is making, you know, maybe $500,000 a year or something working for Google, and, you know, maybe he made as much money as he wanted to, and he's like, yeah, you know, I want to fight the good fight these days, and he's going to jump across the fence. And that's when, you know, people get a little bit nervous. But to your point, and maybe you could just offer some color on this, could you offer some explanation for why it's so complex? Because it gets all the way down to like really arcane aspects of information technology, how data moves from here to there, how it's processed, where it's leveraged. And then, you know, AI is a whole new wrinkle in time that is even harder to understand, as per our opening segment, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Because let's look at all the three major clouds. each one has built itself on a different chipset, a different platform, a different trademark and certified provisioned cloud and infrastructure. Everybody's different. They're not using the same activity. So now you need to have somebody who's knowledgeable in all three areas, all the way down to that chipset or an in-memory solution, and down to a byte level if you want to really get down and dirty from an information security and from an audit transparency. And there's nobody out there. You know, just today I read that the team over at Booz Allen Hamilton, they hired one of the former executive vice presidents at AWS because they're going to be doing work with the federal government on their AWS cloud. And so you're now, you are definitely seeing these folks starting to go out and hire individuals who can be a part of the team that can help them get down to those levels, as well as to help them from other activities around their needs. So it's a That's scary amazing. Proposition when it comes to those three.
Well, and two, to kind of get into something else that we'll talk on various other shows, systems management, right? I did a webinar just yesterday with a company called Unravel Data, and I've done webinars with a few other companies in that space. And, you know, these folks are trying to understand what's actually happening. There's a company called Pepper Data, for example, that is very, very deep and powerful systems management technology. But that's always been hard. Systems management is not an easy, it's not a cakewalk. At the end of the day, you're typically looking at histograms of some kind, and you have to have someone who really understands the nature of workloads and the nature of network challenges, the nature of CPU usage and how it is impacted by specific queries and so forth, to be able to even stitch that stuff together and start addressing the problems. So this is kind of where I'm getting back to. It's such an incredibly complex environment out there. And maybe Kino, I'll bring you back in to kind of jump on this a bit. You guys are doing some very interesting work. In fact, Jupyter Notebooks, if you've ever heard of Jupyter Notebooks, folks, which are really, really cool technologies, the J-U is for Julia Computing. And it's also Python and R. So Python, maybe people have heard about R, is this open source framework. Python is open source. All of this open source technology is out there, even Google TensorFlow. You can use whatever you want. Now, Google wants you to use it in their environment, obviously. That's what they're angling for. But maybe, Kino, just kind of jump on this complexity topic and help us understand, like, how are business people and regulators and all the rest of us lay people out there, and even people inside these organizations, how are we going to stay on top of what's actually happening and how it all works?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question and a really timely question, because we are seeing sort of an explosion of software complexity and layers of abstraction that are employed to make the systems work. And at some point, you got to ask yourself, you know, do I actually need all these layers of abstraction, or do I spend more of my resources fighting against the layers of abstraction than the benefit that I actually get from it? So, you know, one of the things that led to the creation of the Julia programming language was to try to get back to first principles and come up with a system that is not as encumbered by, you know, legacy constraints that have driven decisions in some of these other systems. And it's precisely this flexibility that has allowed us to do things like target GPUs, target TPUs, you know, run on one of the world's largest supercomputers, because we have the flexibility to quickly change parts of a system without having to change it in any of 12 layers that we would have to sit on top of otherwise.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually kind of reminded of a metaphor here that I'll throw out, and maybe Patrick, I'll bring you back in to comment on this. I'm a musician from way, way back when, and with horns and also with some of those old organs, like the pipe organs, for example, the reason those pipes are at different lengths is because we figured out that if you have it at the perfect length to amplify a particular note, a particular frequency, it becomes much more powerful. So in playing horns, for example, like a trumpet, there's a concept of centering your pitch. And if you center your pitch, if you get that frequency exactly right for a C or a C sharp or an F or whatever the case may be, it becomes almost like a laser beam. And I was in drum corps years ago where if someone is 100 yards away from you with a horn, a single trumpet or a cornet or something, if they can center their pitch and they point right at you, you think they're standing right next to you. That's how much more powerful it is. And I think that metaphor kind of carries over to hardware. It's what we're talking about with these chips and these different platforms that companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft are using. There are engineers who really understand systems management, can really understand the nature of workloads. And those are the folks who can essentially center the pitch of the infrastructure to get the maximum output from it. But Patrick, what do you think about that?
Well, for sure. And, but, you know, this is an interesting statistic that I like to throw out. I think none of us on this call count for understanding the plight of the common developer because we're all early adopters. You know, this is what we do.
Right.
And, sorry, I didn't mean to say you don't count, Eric. You're awesome. But, the thing that I remind folks is that, you know, there are 44 million developers in the world right now, and a third of them, and this is the surveys that I've seen from places like Evans and Slash Data, is that a third of them have less than 5 years of experience. And they're building things that are driving the future. And, you know, it's companies like ours that help make that a reality. But the cloud and part of the arms race there, and I keep saying this because I'm like a broken record, but API, API, API. And we're not selling things like per operation per second or based on capacity as much as we are selling an SLA now. I mean, that's how we sell a service anymore is we will give you this. It will give you at this amount of millisecond SLA and it'll cost you this much. And the abstraction is really high up there and it has to be. We cannot build more complex things because complex things fail in complex ways. So this is the trend that I see in it's kind of the burden that we have as well as early adopters is you can't expect everyone to do the complicated thing.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. In fact, we'll have a show coming up in just a few weeks, Lambda No More, Streaming Architectures Rise, talking about the so-called Lambda architecture. If you look it up, L-A-M-B-D-A architecture, is a really interesting idea, very complex idea. And it was designed to be able to leverage both real-time data and historical data in some interesting ways, in some compelling ways. And there are lots of great use cases for that. So, for example, personalization of offers, right? This is something we're going to be seeing a lot more of over the next, well, next 10 to 20 to 10,000 years, however long humans stick around. You're going to see greater and greater efforts to personalize, and that requires a look at historical data, but also a finger on the pulse of the real-time situation. So it's in that nexus that you can do really interesting and creative things. We'll pick that up after the break. So once again, don't touch that dial, folks. You are listening to DM Radio.
Ask yourself, if you built a van for your business, where would you start? At the beginning, of course, with the people who invented the work van over 100 years ago, Mercedes-Benz. You'd give your new Mercedes-Benz Sprinter advanced technology and safety to keep you connected and protected. You'd make it available in diesel and gas, and there would be thousands of configurations and upfits to choose from. You'd build it right here in the USA, because your one-of-a-kind business deserves nothing less than a van that's built for you. Introducing the all-new Mercedes-Benz Sprinter, the safest, most innovative Sprinter yet, starting at just $33,790. Built for you, the all-new Sprinter, built in the USA. Mercedes-Benz, vans, born to run.
MSRP excludes all options, taxes, title, registration, transportation charge, and dealer prep fee. Options, model availability, and actual dealer price may vary. See dealer for details about costs and terms. Equipment described as optional. 2019 Mercedes-Benz Sprinter available soon.
A new year brings new opportunity. Seize it with Quantum Nutrition Lab's three key players for weight management. Promote physical performance and muscle energy with creatine monohydrate. Stimulate fat metabolism with green tea extract. Subdue hunger signals and boost protein intake with our vegan plant protein powder. Buy two bottles, get the third one free. Call 888-588-7578. That's 888-588-7578. 7578 or visit us online at qnlabs.com. That's QNLABS.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bob Marshall, PhD, host of Healthline. Tune in to get your questions answered and hear the latest breakthrough information for you and your family. Our product line, Quantum Nutrition Labs, delivers what others only promise, nutrition that really works.
This is Dr. Mitch Gibson from The Mitch and Kathy Show. Have you ever wondered why you can't talk to people about certain things? Every day we go through life holding back on what we really want to talk about. Yes, there's a lot of talk shows that give you a chance to air your opinions about politics, race relations, and a host of other topics that you're supposed to be thinking about. Well, what about those other areas that you hold back on, such as that ghost you saw when you were a kid, those times when you travel outside your body, that UFO you can't talk about, that you saw in your backyard, those strange people that appear and disappear around you, and you know you're not crazy? On The Mitch and Kathy Show, we give you a chance to talk about stuff like that, things that you hide from the world. In this way, we consider ourselves a guilty pleasure.
Visit themitchandkathyshow.com for more information, or go to gabradionetwork.com.
Welcome back to DM Radio. Here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
All right, folks, back here on DM Radio, talking all about the data center arms race. That's the title for a paper, man, or something, or at least a radio show. But we're talking all about what's happening out there, and my goodness, it's just exciting times, it's challenging times, and I think at the end of the day, you got to go to a few conferences. If you're charged with managing the data center for your organization, if you're charged with migration to the cloud, for example, that's a topic we're going to talk a lot about over the next couple of years. I call it the Great Migration. And what I mean by that is finally enterprise cloud is real. I mentioned that Microsoft is part of that. SAP is part of that. That's a good segue to bring Chris Carter back into the conversation. SAP, they went all in memory, or at least mostly in memory, but B, they're all about S4, and that's in the cloud. That's real-time ERP in-memory architecture in the cloud. To me, SAP absolutely has the cloud religion these days. They're putting a ton of effort in that space. And I like the concept that they talk about. I interviewed Dan Lowell late last year on our other show, Inside Analysis, and he talked about how SAP is focused on a business platform for cloud, which I think is kind of clever, because if you look at like Amazon, for example, it's really they do obviously excellent work over there, but it's kind of a utility is how I view it, at least, or that's how it's positioned. Now, that said, I haven't been to reInvent. I need to go to their conference this year to kind of catch up on all that. But I think it's pretty clever of SAP to focus on what they're calling a business cloud platform and kind of abstracting away the technicalities of it. But Chris, what do you think?
So if you want to come and hear somebody really, really good speak about cloud and SAP, what you should do is you should come to Cloud Expo and hear me. I'll be more than happy to have you in my audience. But because of that, what's going on with SAP, I know, shameless plug for me to hear.
That's okay. That's good.
What's going on and how things are going. I know, really bad shameless plug, right, guys? The activities that are going on from an SAP perspective is the fact that the SAP side of the house is really now being changed and moving around inside of SAP, and it's really allowing organizations to figure out what their data center needs are and then to build around it with the S4 platform. So it gives me the flexibility to be able to build in whatever manner I so choose for a customer.
Wow. Yeah, no, I actually know one of the guys who works on the Cloud Expo. I've been meaning to go check that out. Because it is the future, right? I mean, cloud is the new center of gravity. I think a lot of people realize that, and you have to kind of architect around it. So getting back to big business, right? I mean, cycle times, it takes a long time to do that. I think we're actually in pretty good shape now to begin in earnest that migration, in part because of things like process mining. We're going to do a show on that probably later this year, which I think is one of the most fascinating new kinds of technology out there, where companies like, there's one I met at Sapphire last year, Celonis, that's C-E-L-O-N-I-S, They do process mining where they track the data footprints of transactions across the system and are able to ascertain the de facto business process and then change that. So they can actually write back to SAP and change a business process like order to cash, for example, or loan approval or whatever the case may be. What's really cool, and I'll just get some comments from you, Chris, and then we'll bring Kino back in. What I think is really, really cool here is now we're going to be able to see into these other environments, and there's a whole movement of applications that are not trying to be some new standalone, but instead help you optimize your existing applications. But what do you think about that and migration to the cloud, Chris?
I think you're absolutely correct, especially with the third parties. The only thing they have to be leery of is the licensing schemas to make sure that they're allowed to do the licensing through a third party. But outside of that, the ability to be able to have your S4 environment in a cloud and being able to connect your APIs. And we were, some of the, us were talking about APIs between the breaks and then on this conference, is the fact that now you look at what SAP is doing with Data Hub. We can now connect any API and any third-party solution to SAP and the Data Hub in order to get an analytics view of what's going on. And it's fantastic. It's just wonderful now. And well, you and actually have to build SAP Data Hub with an open source tool.
Wow. Yeah, that's cool. Open source is getting everywhere. And Kino, I'll bring you back in because there's some really interesting stuff with Julia that I'd be wondering if you could kind of talk about a little bit or at least give some color to, right? Which is the ability to ascertain what kind of hardware is out there and then leverage that kind of hardware. And one of the other cool things about Julia that I recall from our last show that we had you guys on is that in the Julia computing language, mathematical symbols actually do what they're supposed to do, right? So you don't have to kind of reconfigure how you write an application to get a mathematical function to execute. I mean, that sounds simple to some folks. It sounds like it should have always been there, but it wasn't. So can you talk about that, Kino, and other cool things that Julia can do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is sort of the flip side of the arms race in hardware is what's the corresponding change in software that we need to do in order to keep up with it. You know, we mentioned TensorFlow earlier on this call, and TensorFlow obviously has a head start on TPUs, but when you're writing TensorFlow code, what you're doing is you're sort of building up a second order program and sort of writing a program that then writes a program that does the math when, you know, you could just try to write the program that does the math directly. And that's what we tried to do in Julia. It's a lot harder because you need to make sure that the thing that you write means the same thing, whether you're targeting CPU, whether you're targeting GPU, whether you're targeting TPU, you know, and across applications as well, right? Machine learning isn't particularly special. It has had a lot of attention recently, particularly in the hardware space, but, you know, there's large-scale simulations, you know, the financial industry has lots of, you know, Monte Carlo simulations that have similar sorts of problems around data movement, around the ability and the need for it to correspond to mathematical syntax, you know, when needing to explain to the regulators what it does, when needing to explain it to people who are familiar with the math but may not be as familiar with the computational side. So this ability to bridge the gap between how do we best describe what's happening to a human and how do we make it fast on all of this different hardware and how do we make it possible for it to be fast, not just on the hardware that we have right now, but on the hardware that we will have next year, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, as all these vendors are improving their capabilities, is a really interesting design question and, you know, something I spend a lot of my day thinking about and prototyping solutions to.
Mm-hmm. No, that is just absolutely fascinating stuff. And I think you made a really good point there. And what you're kind of talking about is that concept of future-proofing, right? You want to future-proof your applications and your environment such that if some major innovation comes along in the hardware space, you're not going to be terribly disrupted by it, right, Kino?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the key to that is to find the right abstractions, find the right way to express things, you know, not over specialize too much to the software that we have right now, and build systems that are flexible enough to adopt to change. Now, it's a lot easier to sort of change the internal pieces of a system than it is to change the APIs and the abstractions that you expose to your customers and your users. So, you know, when TPU v4 comes out, I'm perfectly happy to rewrite my compiler to make your program faster. But it's a lot more challenging for you to rewrite your entire application code, especially if you're not a very technical user. So coming up with the right levels of abstraction now and coming up with easy ways to change it now, I think is the key point to making that happen.
Yeah, and that's actually a perfect segue to Patrick talking all about APIs, right? Application program interfaces. These are the connectors of the web these days. And API design is a big thing, right? Depending upon what you want that thing to do, there are lots of factors that go into it. And there are a number of vendors in that space that are trying to streamline the process of designing them, but it's pretty complex. But Patrick, tell us a bit about why APIs are so important from your perspective.
Well, from my experience, they are either going to make or break the potential technical debt that you're adding to your overall system. So the more ubiquitous and open APIs that you're using, the less chance. I mean, we just heard this, like, I don't have to change my application code. Awesome. Then the underlying data structures, even the database, even the business logic may change a bit, but whenever I ask for something and I get it back through an API call, the contract stays the same. And this, we were joking about Lambda and things like that, but I mean, that's still a very important part of how businesses, every business is a software company now. I can not think of too many that aren't. And so if you're looking at risk for your company, you're thinking like, well, if I like, how many people are still writing PLSQL? Well, they don't want to, or COBOL. They don't want to. I bet they wish that they had something a little more abstracted so they didn't have to get into the weeds. But, this is exactly where I think the future is for us, is learning the lesson of the past.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Learn the lessons of the past. Those who don't know their history are doomed to repeat it, right? Well, folks, we have really explored some interesting territory in the data center arms race. I think we're going to have to do a part two of this show either later this year or early next year, because it's the real thing. It's all about the APIs. It's all about layers of abstraction that make sense. It's all about business. It's all about making sure your business has the data, has the analysis, has what it needs. Folks, with that, we're going to bid you farewell. You have been listening to DM Radio.